I hope you're strapped in and strapped on. The relationship between fatness and sexuality.
There's so many misconceptions and myths. It's this really radical act of self-love to appreciate a larger body in the world that we're in right now.
Howdy, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Sex Essentialist. I'm your host, Em. Today, I am joined by Noelle Benick, a licensed clinical professional counselor and ASECT certified sex therapist based in Baltimore, Maryland. I think you're the first person who's been on the show from Maryland, actually. So I'm just like tallying states off of my checklist, as far as I know, I think. Noelle owns and operates her private practice, Noelle Benick Counseling and Consulting, which opened in January of 2023, but she's been practicing since 2017. And she's currently enrolled in the Modern Sex Therapy Institute's clinical psychology PhD program. So soon to be Dr. Benick?
Soon to be.
Hell yeah. We love to hear it. Noelle, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, we're excited to have you on. And for folks who can't see Noelle as I can, there's some beautiful plants going on in the background. So we love a plant mom moment. So before we get into today's topic, which we'll chat through here in a second, Noelle, can you share with the audience sort of how you identify, whatever that means to you?
Yeah. So sort of big factors that make up my intersectionality, I'd say, would be I am a fat, queer, and neurodivergent human. I am a cis white woman. And I feel really deeply tied to my career as a therapist, particularly as a sex therapist.
I love that. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
And today's topic, folks, we'll get into, but at a high level, we're going to talk about some of the intersectionality that Noelle just mentioned, in particular, kind of the overlap between fatness and sexuality. But before we get into that, everyone knows I love a good story. And Noelle has been kind enough to bring a little anecdote to the table for us today. So, Noelle, I'm going to hand it over to you. What is a classic Noelle sex and or dating or relationships or other related story?
Okay. I will preface this by saying if you are my family member or you don't want to hear something that you can't unhear, I'm going to say like hit that fast forward button like 30 seconds because this is quick, but you're not going to want to hear it.
Perfect.
So I'm married. I've been with my spouse for about a decade at this point. We've been married for 3 years. But that was also, has been my first and only queer relationship. And so I think in getting to know my spouse, there were a lot of firsts for me, both personally, sexually, and otherwise. And one of the funniest stories that I can think of is one time I was going down on my spouse and it was this lovely time of year where it is getting a little bit colder and drier and I'm doing my thing. We're both enjoying ourselves. This is this one wonderful time. And I sort of get up and they look at me and were like, oh my gosh. And it was because my entire face was covered in blood. And the first instinct there is to think like, oh no, like this is a menstrual blood. This is, you know, not to yuck anybody else's yum, but that would be something that my partner wouldn't be super comfortable with. And I'm not particularly jazzed about, but okay, yeah, it happens. But it wasn't menstrual blood. I got a nosebleed and I get nosebleeds all the time, but it happened while I was down there and didn't even realize it till afterwards. And it did look like I was in a horror movie, not engaging in consensual play with my partner.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, regardless of how often you get a nosebleed, like that is an unfortunate time for a number of reasons, but I like my natural inclination is like you must be like such a giving lover that you just like didn't even notice. I mean, I've never had a big like nosebleed, but in my head like you feel it and you were just like I'm going to Flavortown, and
it's all warm and moist, and you know, blood and other secretions, I guess, are more similar than we give it credit for.
True. Yeah, I love it. You're like, I'm doing my business, and then there it was. Yeah,
you might as well finish.
I was gonna say at first, I definitely thought it was gonna be a period story, and I was like, oh my gosh, you unintentionally got your red wings, which is a phrase I learned through someone else having the experience of being given head when they started their own period. And then something else. I'm sure there's a sex term for getting a nosebleed while giving head. Sure.
I feel like I'm like giving the red wings.
You gave the red wings. Truly giving in all regards.
Yeah, I'm just a giving lady, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, what can you say? That's awesome. So as I mentioned to folks, we're talking about some of the relationship between fatness and sexuality. And one of the things I wanted to do before we get into my questions is ask you about language. So there's been a reclamation of the word fat, obviously, in recent years. But what language should we as a culture, even you and I in today's conversation, be using to aid kind of in the body liberation movement, whether that be fat or plus size or larger bodied or whatever that looks like?
So I think that, like a lot of things, it's important to ask who you're talking to and what they prefer.
Yeah.
So for someone like myself, I really embrace the word fat now, sort of having the reclamation of that term and having it be neutral and at times empowering has been an important part of my journey. And other people aren't going to resonate with that. So if I don't know somebody's preferences or I'm speaking sort of to a larger group, I will typically use the term larger bodied people, larger body folks. But I'm always curious with how people sort of identify themselves and what's the language that they use. And of course, we always want to be person first rather than saying like, you're, you know, a larger bodied person rather than like a person that has a larger body. That's always great practice too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great insight. I think for folks, I know in the sex ed or sex therapy space, but also just in life, are always like, I want to support larger body folks, or I want to support this notion of fat reclamation or reclamation of that term. You know, how do I talk to people about it? And with anything in any issue, really, it's always, I think, like you said, important to talk to the people and make sure that, like, I think if you use the term fat, clarify that you're not using it in a disparaging way, right? That it's more of that empowerment angle. Great. Well, thank you for clarifying that. I think that's helpful for everyone. Yeah. So I'd love to hear a little bit about your own personal journey and sort of how that translated into the professional work that you do.
Yeah. So it's really hard for me to separate out my identity as a fat queer person from my identity as a therapist. I am not, and I have never been that kind of like blank screen type of therapist that just sort of shows up. I'm very much myself in sessions, and I value the relationships that I form with my clients. And I'd like to be able to be myself in that. Many therapists, this will hopefully resonate, there's this like cosmically cruel phenomenon where if you have unfinished business that you need to do on yourself, it's going to show up in session. The second that I'm quarreling with something internally, that's the moment I'll have one or two clients bring up the exact same thing in that week. And it just sort of really forces you to think and grow through it. So there's this dual influence there, seeing my clients' struggles and journeys in terms of their, how they think about their own bodies and how they're perceiving, you know, fatness and queerness and all of these things has allowed me to hold more compassion for myself and, you know, challenge me to learn more, do more through therapy, self-reflection, consuming more information, and that enables me to show up as a better therapist for my clients.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. I mean, I think I talk about therapy, I feel like, every episode because, one, I obviously talk to a lot of people in a therapy or counselor position in some shape or form, tends to, you know, there's overlap there. But I am so glad my therapist doesn't listen to the show, because I'm all like every episode, I'm like, I love my therapist.
I'm sending my therapist this and being like, listen to this. You're going to be so proud of me.
Yes. Please do. I love it. And let me know what your therapist says, because I love feedback from people who are close to the guests that I have. But yeah, it's a really good question. I always like, I wonder that very thing with my therapist, like how do her identities come into play? Anyway, this isn't an episode about my therapist, but I love that you said that because at least for me as a patient, a client holds true. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that there are some therapists that are dialed in because I talked to many of you. But so I think one of the things that I'm curious about is in your experience kind of both personally and professionally, like what are some of the misconceptions or stereotypes about larger bodied folks in terms of their sexuality that you encounter, again, like either in your own experience or kind of in your professional life?
Yeah. So I guess big question is how much time do you have? Because there are so many misconceptions and myths about fatness and sexuality and how they intertwine. Yeah. And unfortunately, studies are pretty limited. Data is limited because we exist in a society that doesn't care about fat people or actively wants to eradicate them. Mm. So I have a bunch of like myths and I don't know, anecdotes to those myths.
Yeah.
But one of the big things that always strikes me is there was this study done in 2002 that got published in Obstetrics and Gynecology, which is a pretty big publication. And they surveyed 7,000 women for the purpose of trying to prove that fat women don't have sex. And they were sort of... They were proved wrong in the sense that 92% of overweight women reported having sexual intercourse with men, as opposed to 87% of people women that fell within a normal BMI range. Right. I'm doing intense air quotes
now because
I am a big believer in the idea that the BMI system is ridiculous and not.
Yeah.
It's so unnecessary, and yet we use it to discriminate against people all the time.
Yeah.
But the study really indicates that all people, fat people included, deserve, you know, to be educated on best practices for their sexual health, regardless of BMI, regardless of any of these other factors. Mm-hmm. Preconceived notions on who has sex based on something as our subjective perception of how attractive they are or how desirable they are. It's just ridiculous. So myth number one is fat people don't have sex. I can say personally, anecdotally, I could prove that wrong.
Yeah.
but studies will also support that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's let's be clear that BMI is fake, right? Like it's one of many decisions that has led to systemic, oppression, really, of folks of marginalized communities, fat people included, larger body people included. And so one of the things that I feel like I encounter in being in the space and in talking to larger bodied friends of mine is that there is this spectrum, right, where there's this, either an assumption of, you know, asexuality, basically, or the like fetishization of larger bodied folks, right? And that it's either you don't have sex or you're an object or a fetish, right? And there's truly no like media representation of anything in between, unless you're really seeking out, you know, like ethical porn that's created for folks who are looking for, you know, realistic information.
Right. And there's an element of like, you know, somebody who's looking for ethical porn doesn't want to spend, you know, 15, 20 minutes on finding something that fits what they are looking for, or, you know, has bodies that they can relate to and see their own selves in. It's really unfortunate. And I think the way that you just phrased it really sums it up.
Yeah. Are there other
so many
big
more
myths? Yeah. I mean, hey, why don't you hit me with the next top two?
Okay. We'll
go from there.
So other things, let's see. Fat people can't have good sex. So a lot of people just assume, because in our society we equate fatness with laziness and sort of like ethical shortcomings and unattractiveness and ugliness. Yeah. We assume fat people don't have sex, but we don't have good sex. We think, and when I say we, I mean society at large, not, I am not a part of this we.
Yeah, yeah.
People will assume, you know, fat people can't access or find their genitals.
Right.
They are struggling with hygiene concerns and things like that. But plenty of people with larger bodies have good sex. And that sex may or may not be with other larger bodied folks, but also with their thin and straight size counterparts. Body size does not equate to flexibility levels, you know. There are so many different positions that larger bodied folks can access and enjoy, and that their partners can enjoy with them.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. I think when you said that, I was like, who was making this assumption? But when you spelled it out like that, I can see where like society's view on fat folks skews it that way. And like, when I think about things like positions, like I have multiple books, as many people in this space do, on different sex positions. And like most people can't do half of them because sex positions in books are crazy. But like there are positions for everyone that are accessible for everyone, regardless of what body size or shape or accessibility they require, right, or have.
Right. And also there's modifiers for these things. Like you can get yourself wedge pillows. You can get yourself dildos with handles for more access or control. Like there's so many different things that you can access that you may or may not even need. Right.
For sure.
You have fulfilling sexual interactions with, you know, multiple partners.
Totally. I have chronic joint pain and I love a wedge pillow because it takes the pressure off of parts of my body that just don't have the stamina to hold me where I want to be to experience pleasure. But bodies are vehicles for pleasure, period, right? Mm-hmm. They're also vehicles for every other emotion or feeling that we have in life. And that's part of what makes life magical and beautiful. But everyone is capable of experiencing pleasure. Mm-hmm. And it's wild to me that anyone questions that because of someone's shape or size.
Right.
You mentioned dildos with handles. I know that there are some sex educators or like sex toy retailers who cater to or market to larger bodied folks for more accessible toys. Is that something that you've found to be helpful, or is the conversation around things like, you know, quote unquote, fat friendly sex toys more hindering than it is helpful in terms of language and media?
I think as long as the information is being provided in a way that isn't inherently fat phobic or sort of like valuing thinner bodies over fat ones, it's super helpful to have the information. I mean, any larger bodied person will not be surprised to hear me say it's hard to find clothing or furniture designed for larger bodies.
Yeah.
The same thing can apply to sex toys, but that doesn't mean that there aren't great companies and entire markets out there that are producing products that can be enhancing for larger bodied people and, you know, straight sized people as well.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is like not every sex toy is for every person, period. Right. Again, regardless of body, like it's just, if you like a sex toy, you like a sex toy. If, you know, you get a hand cramp when you use a sex toy, then maybe try a different position. I don't know what else to tell you. Right. And that's a human experience, not a limited experience.
No, definitely not.
Okay. Misconception number three. Hit me.
All right. Fat people are unattractive. Like, there are people out there. I don't know how people believe this when someone like Tess Holliday exists, right?
Right.
Like, fucking gorgeous.
Yeah, for sure.
And something tells me that her 2.6 million or whatever it is up to right now, Instagram followers find her plenty attractive.
Yeah.
So that's a big one that I think a lot of people struggle with. They really equate fatness with ugliness.
Yeah.
And they are two completely different things.
Totally. Well, and I think that, I mean, that's obviously, or maybe it's to me, it's obvious, maybe it's not obvious for everyone. Like, that's completely tied into media representations of attractiveness, right? And we talk about this so much now in the form of Instagram and TikTok. Before it was, you know, print media and billboards and magazines and whatever, right? But, you know, like so many things, in my opinion, and I'd love to hear your opinion, like, concepts of quote unquote beauty come from the fact that we live in a capitalist consumerist society that dictates what we're supposed to buy.
And yes,
it benefits the corporations if we want to look a certain way, because we have to buy more things to get there, right? Like, it's
right.
like BMI, it's fake, right? It's misconstrued,
right. Well, and anti-fat bias is so deeply rooted in capitalism.
Yeah.
The dieting industry is hundreds of billions of dollars are poured into this industry. And it has like a 97% fail rate. People who invest in these diet and exercise programs and these quick fixes and these magical solutions are consistently let down, and we just keep throwing more money at it.
Yeah.
Society and these corporations and companies really profit by making people hate themselves. And
for sure.
It's horrible and cruel, and it is so incredibly profitable.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have had conversations recently about it always comes up, because when I teach sex ed, I'm teaching, you know, podcasts is for adults, but when I teach, it's usually with youth. And so much of what I think about now today is media literacy. And I find, you know, up until really recently, media representations of things like romance or like being an action star are associated, you know, with, as you phrase, straight bodied people, right? And that you have, when you have larger bodied folks in movies or TV show, they don't fit into the heroine or hero bucket, right? And so, you know,
they're the supporting role. They're the fat, funny friend. They're, you know, this person that just simply exists to elevate others, and their own narratives are on the back burner.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's the combination of corporations like the diet industry, the beauty industry, the cosmetic surgery industry, whatever, however many you want to loop in, because so many of them are part of it, right? But it's also our box offices, right? It's our production companies and our casting directors. And we could go on, right? The system's broken. But we know where some of these assumptions come from.
Right. So many of us grew up in households where there were limitless microaggressions towards larger bodied folks, or just like in households that vilified fatness. So, you know, hearing your parent say something like, "Oh, we can walk this off after dinner," or "I worked out, so now I deserve a treat," or you know, just these little comments that build up and build up, and they just cut right through.
Yeah. I mean, it's so much of our self-worth and the value that we have in society is tied to things like that because of colloquialisms, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they are microaggressions, but they're treated, I mean, like, that's what a microaggression is, really. They're treated so casually, so informally, and you know, that's one of the many things that I talk about this in therapy all the time, is like, I choose not to have kids. I'm consciously child free because I'm aware of my own shit. And I'm aware of the fact that words you say casually without thinking as a parent deeply impact your child. And we live in a system that's perpetuating fat phobia or fat phobic microaggressions in that way as well.
Definitely, definitely. And most of the time, maybe most of the time is generous, but I like to give people the benefit of the doubt. It's well-intentioned, right? The person that tells me I have such a pretty face isn't saying, and your body is ugly, but that's what I hear. And it's, you know, it's so hurtful, and those things really do build up. So sort of like leaning away from that and finding space to appreciate a larger body, it's this really radical act of self-love in the world that we're in right now.
Yeah, I'm processing that, but you're right, right? There are things like that where it's an omission that people, hopefully, like you said, most of the time aren't even conscious of, but it's inherently tied to the way that society's constructed our views of bodies and what bodies are deemed worthy, if you will. Those are some hard-hitting myths and misconceptions that we're dispelling. Do you have any others that you were like, this one we got to talk about?
I have one more, and it sounds silly, but I can't tell you how many people will come into my office and disclose this exact fear. Fat people are afraid that they are going to break their sexual partners. It becomes so inhibiting that they are afraid to be on top during sex, or they're afraid to receive pleasure, or they're afraid that they're going to hurt their partner beyond repair with their body. And it's laughable, but it's also so sad. You know, open communication and telling your partner if you need to switch positions to help avoid injuries or unwanted pain in these experiences, that's true for everyone, not just larger bodies.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I talk to folks in the BDSM space all the time, and I applaud the BDSM space all the time, because I feel like it's situations like that, like BDSM and kink, that you have to negotiate in advance and open the gateway to transparent and direct and immediate communication. And so much of society revokes that ability, that accessibility for folks who aren't in the kink and BDSM space, because they're we're told, or we're not supposed to talk about sex, you're not supposed to ruin the moment. But it's exactly right. Like I mentioned, there are some positions for me where I'm like, my body hurts, my bones hurt, I need to move. And in any situation, people can have the risk of physical discomfort, but that is not tied to body shape or size. And also, my jaw dropped when you said that, because I was like, it is just, I mean, to me, it sounds like something that people have been fed over and over and over again, and fear, and it creates an absolutely unnecessary amount of shame around engaging in any kind of sex activity at all, which sucks, because all bodies are for feel good things. Like that's what bodies are for,
right? And all bodies are deserving of that experience of pleasure if that's something that they're seeking.
And I imagine that must be very isolating for some of your clients to feel, not just that they're not deserving, of course, but that they are going to cause harm, because no one wants to associate their sexual pleasure with the harm of others. Or if they do, they're a bad person, and that's, we're not getting into that today, but.
I think there's also this idea of like, if by chance they do cause harm, it's because they're fat. It's because they're this big bumbling idiot, right? In the way that society and media can portray larger body folks, you know, it's this like brutish archetype. And that is not at all representative of most fat people.
Totally. Well, and it's such a double-edged sword, because I feel like when sex injuries happen, as they do with many people, if someone is straight-bodied, it's like a bit, I feel like, in media or anecdotally, I feel like people are like, oh, yeah, I, you know, pop my kneecap during doggy style, and it was, right. You know, sucks, but it was funny. Whereas you put someone in a situation, that happened to my mom, but if you put someone in a situation where there's a larger bodied person involved, it's not going to be a bit, because they can't be, because people around right. them treat it as a, oh, it's, you know, it's because of, you know, your body size, right? And as opposed right. to,
right. Or if it's a bit, it becomes this self-deprecating, like really insidious, toxic humor where I have to make the joke first, so that way you can't make fun of me. I mean, that is how I made it through high school, was like being the fat, funny friend who could beat anybody to the punchline, because if anybody's going to say anything negative about my body, I'm going to do it first.
Yeah, it's a defense mechanism. Right. But it's certainly not an affirmation to one. Because even if you're the one making the joke, like, you're internalizing it as well, just as much as hearing it from other people.
And that hurts you, but it also hurts all the people around you. And I think that that's something that we often forget with self-deprecating humor, which, you know, humor can be a beautiful defense mechanism. It can have so much utility, but in situations like this where you are making fun of your body, who else is hearing that, right? Is it other partners who struggle with their own self-image? Is it, you know, vulnerable people who are, you know, like teenagers who are, their minds are still being shaped and they're growing and everything is like about their social hierarchy.
Yeah.
You know, who's hearing this and interpreting that as, oh, there's something wrong with me too.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. In that case, right, or any of these cases, whether it's someone else or like aimed at yourself, there's risk of harm to anyone, right? It's perpetuating what society's established, that you and I have established here, is doing nothing but harm, right? Or at least the greater society. That's not to say there aren't pockets of folks with or organizations that promote body liberation or body positivity, but
the majority has not caught up.
Yeah, one of the things that I feel like I've encountered quite a bit on social media over the last couple of years is, in tandem with some of the like fat reclamation and fat empowerment, there's also sort of toxic body positivity. I think like toxic positivity and toxic body positivity both really came to fruition most potently in the height of COVID, but really like it's been an ongoing kind of development. Can you talk a little bit about what maybe like toxic body positivity looks like and how people can seek to be like positive and supportive of themselves and others while also avoiding sort of this toxic form of it?
Right. So I think it can be helpful to sort of talk about the differences between body positivity and body neutrality, because I feel like the line between those is where it can sort of move into toxicity.
Yeah.
So to carry an assumption that you should love and feel great about all parts of your body all the time is so incredibly unrealistic.
Yeah.
And I think that it often makes people feel really intimidated, and they'll say, you know, how am I supposed to feel positive about my body? It's hard for me to even feel comfortable in my body. And I've been just spoon-fed messages about what's right and what's wrong. And this is something that, you know, straight-sized people and larger-bodied folks are going to struggle with, you know, at differing rates, but it's not just something that impacts fat folks. Body neutrality is sort of like, okay, like I have a body, I am not my body. My body can do these things for me, but it doesn't always have to do these things for me. It's not rooted in these like ableist principles of like, I have legs so I can run, because that's not everybody can do that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's a really important distinction. I find like most of the language I've seen in recent years is a leaning towards body liberation, which is why I use that language. But I think that doesn't necessarily doesn't resonate with everyone. It's such like it's a term associated, I think, linguistically with activism, which is wonderful and beautiful. But at the same time, your point about body neutrality, like that's everyone on a day-to-day basis is just seeking to be comfortable enough, and it'll vary mm-hmm. per day with their in their own skin and mm-hmm. seeing what your body can do and being excited by that in its own right.
Yeah. And I also think it's important to note people are angry when fat people feel okay about themselves.
Mm.
People can sometimes become enraged when fat people feel positively about themselves.
Yeah.
So I can't tell you the number of comments that I laugh at and delete on Instagram and stuff, and people who will accuse me of like glorifying obesity. When, I mean, so what if I was?
Yeah.
But also, you know, we glorify plenty of things in our society that, you know, yeah. we can place different moral values on. But because it is so foreign to think about fat people not hating themselves,
yeah.
it causes so much confusion and misunderstanding, and that turns into anger for people.
Yeah.
What do you mean you don't want to go on this diet plan? What do you mean you don't want to work out?
Yeah.
It's such a jarring experience to say, yeah, I feel pretty good about myself, and someone to come back and be like, ew, why?
Yeah. I think that anger response is, I mean, it's something that I struggled to fathom, because I just think like humans are humans and everyone's doing their thing and we're all doing the best that we can. But
it'd be cool if everybody could adopt that policy.
Yeah, it's I see it in response to folks loving themselves, right, in whatever kind of identity they own, right? Whether it's fat folks, whether it's Black folks, whether it's yeah. other folks of marginalized communities, right? When people get so up in arms about someone loving who they are and they treat it like it's this criminal activity, I'm like, what is going on? It's one of those really heinous symptoms of the greater issues at hand, but it's something that I don't think can be resolved without some of the greater systemic issues and perspectives being crumbled or rebelled against in full. But I'm sorry that people do that on your Instagram, and it's your Instagram's great. Don't let anyone get you down.
I will screenshot the comment, send it to my wife, send it to my friends, and we'll laugh, and then it'll be erased, and I won't allow other people to take in that negativity.
Yeah.
But that negativity does not pierce me in the way that it mm-hmm. would have, you know, even just a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Well, and that's why folks need you or need therapy in general, right? It's like some of that mm-hmm. is building up. I don't want to say a wall, because I don't want to act like it's something that's keeping people out, but it's to build mm-hmm. up the shield from harmful people with harmful words who have nothing better to do than try to make other people miserable.
Right. Well, and I think it really brings in the role of representation, you know, mm-hmm. growing up. And I wasn't even a particularly large teenager, but I was larger than some of my friends, mm-hmm. but was still, you know, I was an athlete, and I shouldn't have to even justify any of these things.
No.
Nobody should have treated me poorly, regardless of what I look like or what size I was. So I don't want to go too far down that tangent.
Yeah.
But I grew up not seeing larger bodied people, queer people being successful or happy. Even in graduate school, I was terrified that people would not want to work with me because I was fat. I used to believe mm-hmm. that every single one of my problems would go away if I could just lose weight. And that's incorrect.
Definitely incorrect.
Solved a lot of those problems. And I also have I have a really successful therapy practice.
Yeah.
I work with some amazing people. I'm able to, you know, provide a lifestyle that is completely comfortable and wonderful for my partner and I. I did not think that that would be within reach because I was fat.
I want to give some snaps because you're thriving and I love it.
Thank you.
Like it's finding the beauty and your own right and identifying that you are successful because of who you are and mm-hmm. that who you are and everything you've experienced has led to everything that you're able to achieve and be capable of. And also like success looks different for everyone as well. Like, you know, and achievement looks different for everyone as well. There's not one copy and paste way to be successful. And so I hope folks listening identify what makes them feel fulfilled and figure out the best course of action to get to that, regardless of who they are and what they look like. But
yeah, definitely. And not to undermine, like, obviously I have a lot of privilege in also being a cis white woman. And even though my queer identity is a really sort of core part of me, I can blend in as a heterosexual person in a crowd. Like there are elements of my intersectionality that people aren't aware of, and that comes with privilege as well.
For sure. And everyone, I mean, most folks have privilege in some shape or form, and that's not to at all undermine your success because you worked hard for what you do. And I love to hear that your practice is
keeping it. We can hold both.
Totally. For sure. Yeah. So one really on that note, actually, I'd love to hear how, in your experience, like how does the intersection of body size or being larger bodied, kind of with gender identity or sexual orientation kind of impact mm-hmm. an individual's experience of their own sexuality and relationships? Because it is, I mean, not to say it's like a double whammy, but obviously as soon as you
it's a double whammy
on, yeah like we layer on like identities that are in some way marginalized, right? Becomes complicated always.
Definitely. So I think there are so many parallels between, like you said, any marginalized identity. So there's, you know, in thinking about being queer and coming out, I also think that people have to come out to an extent, not in the sense of, oh, people will not be able to tell that I'm fat. But so much of my life was spent trying to conceal my fatness and sort of like trick or hide it from others. You know, all my clothes were black and everything was baggy or like an A-frame because God forbid that somebody know that I have a soft tummy.
Right.
And in the same way, it sort of paralleled my queerness, right? Like I could hide this. I could conceal this. It wasn't something for other people to know.
Yeah.
And in the process of sort of owning both of these parts of my identity, I've found so much relief and freedom. You know, it takes so much time and emotional energy to conceal. Yeah. And, you know, it's also its own kind of, it's its own labor to deal with people perceiving me as a fat and queer person. But I think that it took much more emotional labor to hide those parts of me. And I think also there's sometimes a misconception because people will assume fat people are ugly and unlovable and unwanted. In my coming out process, I was challenged by, you know, people who were incredibly close to me, who did a lot of harm, who tried to say, oh, I don't think you're gay. I just don't think that boys like you. Wow. And that like really fucking hurts.
Yeah.
And it's also wildly untrue.
Yeah.
So there's all of these dynamics that sort of intertwine. And then also speaking to sort of other experiences outside of my own, body size impacts people's perceptions of masculinity and femininity. And you know, when we picture sort of an androgynous kind of queer person, the image that comes to mind for most people is a very slim person. And, you know, gender and sexuality and gender expression can vary so much in a way that has nothing to do with body size, but we seem to value the appearance and validate the existence of slim queer folks more than we do larger bodied fat folks.
Well, one, I'm really sorry to hear that people questioned your queerness because of your body. I guess I shouldn't be surprised because people suck. but I'm sorry that that happened, and that you were invalidated in that way. And I'm glad that you're living your hashtag best queer life. But yeah, I think, like, when I think about, you know, sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression, all of these things are on massive spectrums, right? I mean, mm-hmm. anatomy is on a spectrum. Like, there are so many things that fall into what, for people who think still in the binary, that mm-hmm. it confuses them visually. And I think mm-hmm. when you add the element of being larger bodied or seeing a larger bodied queer person or a larger bodied trans person, or non-binary or whatever, you know, gender diverse identity that person has, it's like there's like an inability to compute on like mm-hmm. multiple levels. Like you said, there's so many misconceptions just by looking at a person, identifying their body shape or size and making an assumption. And then when you look at a queer person or a trans person, assumptions are made and then people just get mad yeah. because they can't relate.
Right. And I mean, I also have clients who just get concerned with like aesthetic elements of things of, you know, if you are a larger bodied trans or non-binary person who's like looking to have top surgery.
Yeah.
I've had people say, oh, but what will I look like if I have a big belly and I don't have, you know, breast tissue? Mm. You know, and will I look out of proportion and will I look weird? And sort of it becomes very limiting and I think brings up a lot of dysphoria for people.
Yeah.
Because the assumption is that won't match the desired aesthetic that society has set that I should have.
Yeah. In cases like this or in general, I guess, like, how do you recommend or how do you work with clients towards being able to make decisions that fulfill them, whether from a gender-affirming standpoint or just in their day-to-day?
Yeah. I mean, I think you almost answered your own question in that. It's such a personal experience and everybody mm-hmm. has to decide to do what will feel best for them. So it's never my role to tell someone in therapy what they should do.
Yeah.
But rather to just help them explore, you know, what are they worried about? Where are the contradictions? Can I point those things out? What's going to help them feel more at home yeah. in their body?
Mm-hmm. Our bodies are our homes, right? They're mm-hmm. the only consistent home we have while we're alive. For folks who know what they want and know what feels good, but don't feel like they are worthy of that, or maybe they are scared to pursue it for one reason or another, are there tools or resources or methods of self-reflection that you found to be helpful in folks trying to, you know, get over the fear or get over the mm-hmm. self-effacing thoughts?
Mm-hmm. So I think it can be helpful to sort of compartmentalize, like, thinking about the level of distress that comes from having breasts, right? Or having like a larger chest area for somebody who is non-binary or for somebody who is trans,
mm-hmm.
And sort of holding space for exploring the dysphoria and the discomfort that causes and separating that out while not completely separating.
Yeah.
You know, how does that relate to other parts of their body? I think finding a sense of community, taking in images of other trans and non-binary people who have had this surgery and yeah. seeking to, you know, normalize bodies that look different and bodies that come in all shapes and sizes and removing this like moral judgment from them.
Mm.
But it's such a deeply personal experience.
Mm.
And my goal is to just sort of provide them with the support to think about all of these things and, you know, if and when they are ready and want to seek, you know, gender affirming surgeries, to be the support for them and to make sure that they understand, you know, all the risks and benefits and all of sort of what they can expect from the process.
Mm, yeah. That's helpful, I think, for folks listening in, especially too, who maybe are facing some of these questions themselves. Existentialist is pretty queer listener base, so I'm sure that applies to someone out there as well. So one of the things I wanted to touch on as well is that I know you mentioned that you work with couples, and you mentioned working with folks who are ethically non-monogamous. For folks listening who aren't sure what that means, I've done many episodes on different forms of non-monogamy. Shameless plug, but I have already explained lots of this, so go back and listen to those, and then you can ask me some questions in my DMs if you're still confused. But can you talk about how, if at all, being larger bodied comes into play with some of the dynamics of being non-monogamous and having some unique challenges or perspectives kind of associated with having multiple people involved in a relationship dynamic?
Yeah. So I think, kind of like we touched on earlier in the episode, there is a unfortunate occurrence where a lot of times fat folks, larger body folks, are fetishized or they're determined to be unattractive, unworthy, whatever. And all of those dynamics, just as they would exist in monogamous relationships, also show up for ethically non-monogamous and poly folks.
Yeah.
I have a lot of larger body clients, those in particular who are in mixed weight relationships. So they have one partner who is larger bodied and one person who is more like of that, like straight size. And when I say straight size, like somebody who can go into a store and buy clothes without fearing that they, you know, won't be able to find something that fits them.
Right.
So in mixed weight relationships, a lot of times the larger body partner has a deep fear that they are going to be perceived as less desirable to their partner and that they will be, you know, left behind if they're doing group play. Are people engaging with them in the same way? You know, is their partner able to find other partners more easily than them because of their weight, because of their size? You know, there's a lot of concerns of how do we go through this in a way that actually feels ethical, where one partner isn't being left behind because the other partner has a, like, higher social value or people perceive them to be more attractive.
That's complicated. That there's a lot of dynamics of, I mean, ethical non-monogamy can be it requires a lot from everyone involved in order to be happy and safe and healthy. It's like all relationships should be. All relationships take work, but when you got more cooks in the kitchen, it's just
a lot.
Yeah. You mentioned social value, and it's an interesting way. I don't think we've used that phrasing on the episode, and I think it's an important lens on what we've been talking about. But have you found that there are ways for or tools people can find to effectively communicate and resolve some of that internal or maybe external strife as it arises?
Yeah. And I definitely think it's a dual process, right? There are feelings to be worked through individually, and there are things to be sorted out in these relationships. One thing that I like to remind my clients of is different does not equate to better or worse. So a lot of times we find ourselves in these comparison traps of, okay, if my partner is dating someone who's thinner than me, are they inherently more attractive? Are they going to have more energy? Are they going to be able to do these positions that I can't or don't want to do? And reminding clients to, like, sort of look back and think about, like, okay, maybe they will interact differently, but does that inherently mean that they are better than you? Like, clearly you're both going to bring different things to the table. That's kind of the point of being non-monogamous, is that you're going to have people that can offer you different things, and needs and desires can be spread out in a way that is equitable, in a way that monogamous relationships can't always provide. So can it be completely fine that you're different? Can you both be wonderfully attractive and sexy and desirable in different ways.
Yeah, totally.
Variety is the spice of life. Like, yes. Having different size partners with, you know, body parts that feel different, like, that's fun.
Yeah, that's a really great way of putting it. I mean, it's like anything else, right? You have, like, trying something new is fun and exciting.
I think also doing some work to vet potential partners, to seeing, like, what's their level of awareness of anti-fat bias? Yeah. How do they show up? Are they going to demean or be, you know, hitting one partner with a ton of microaggressions?
Yeah.
Especially if you're sort of engaging in shared play where you're having group sex.
Yeah.
Is it group sex if one of you is being left out the whole time? Like, how yeah. does this other person or people value all of the bodies that are in that group? And then also having some space to talk about boundaries. What is preferred language? You know, does it offend you if I call you fat? Can I touch this area of your body? Or are there certain parts that are off limits? Are there certain physical activities that make you feel more or less comfortable in that scenario? I do applaud my non-monogamous folks in that they're generally really wonderful. The ones that do it well are great at talking about these boundaries and having these very explicit conversations that people sometimes otherwise can shy away from.
Totally. Yeah. And this is why, I mean, I should include non-monogamous and poly folks when I applaud certain kink and BDSM communities for this. But it's really the over communication, right? It's the we have to talk about it, so we're gonna. Otherwise, someone might get hurt. And it's important to make a space for that, even if you're in, you know, the most quote unquote vanilla. I'm not going to, you know, I don't, all sex is wonderful. I don't care who you do it with. But
vanilla is still a spice.
Exactly. And it's also like, negotiate your shit, right? Like, talk about what you like and don't like. Talk about your boundaries. Everyone has them. And
yeah, yeah. And just something as simple as language can really influence people's experiences. Like, some people might really love dirty talk, and someone saying like, yeah, I love your big fat ass is like a turn on, and it's like, wow, that's empowering. And for other people, they would be like, oh dear God, why would you say that to me now? I'm shutting down and collapsing inward.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's so important to define those things ahead of time and like setting an expectation. And also, like, I understand, and I make space for this when we talk about things like dirty talk or negotiating anything in the bedroom. Like, sometimes you don't know until it happens, right? Sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and that's okay. But also, like, I seek to empower everyone to like take a moment, and you can find a sexy way to do it, but like, check in, right? If you have that moment where you're like caving in on yourself, like, don't endure it. It's not good for anyone's body or mind to sit and endure things that don't feel good.
Yeah.
But I'd love to just make sure that we've covered kind of everything you wanted to. If there are points that you wanted to make that we haven't made, I'd love to kind of hold time for that as well.
Yeah. I feel like the only point that I didn't really necessarily hit.
Yeah.
That definitely I think is important is remembering fat phobia kills people.
It
kills people through irresponsible medical care. It kills people through, you know, people being shamed and not listened to at a doctor's office for so long that they just come to avoid it. It, you know, it harms people through eating disorders. It harms people through suicide. And it's just this really horrible, insidious thing that in an ideal world has no place in our society. So making space to recognize that it is a dire concern, how we treat people and how we sort of hold space for certain bodies and don't hold space for others in not just sexual realms, but in all facets of life. There are very serious implications for that.
Yeah. I mean, you, to bring it full circle, right? You mentioned at the beginning of this episode that, you know, people don't do studies on larger bodied experiences, right? We don't mm-hmm. have, I mean, the study you cited came out in 2002, right? I mean, that's, it's bonkers that we're living mm-hmm. in a 2023 world. And I mean, when this comes out, it'll be 2024, but there are so many scientific stories to tell, whether it pertains to larger bodied folks or not, right? But the fact that we in particular mm-hmm. are negating bodies that we treat as lesser than as a society, it's one of those things where we see so much violence in our media. We're certainly not, at least in the US here, not immune to violence. In fact, we often don't shy away, enough away from it as we should, mm-hmm. but we hide the violence that is inconvenient to address in the media, right? And I think having lack of, you know, equitable access to healthcare in itself is violence, right? It's not yeah. the grotesque violence you hear about, but it does, it kills people, and it's important to acknowledge, like you said, it is a dire concern and an immediate concern.
Yeah, it's so wildly insidious.
Yeah. And healthcare from a physical and mental standpoint, like you said.
Right. Yeah. Because, I mean, medical doctors, I think, are often more guilty of this. But
yeah,
therapists also do this. You know, I've had therapists historically. I have the best therapist now. She's so fucking cool. but I've had therapists before suggest that, you know, my weight was a result of trauma or sexual trauma, which like isn't something that I dealt with. Yeah. I've had therapists encourage me to lose weight or diet. I've had things like that, which just, it causes so much harm when you're looking for someone who can yeah. hold space for you and listen to you and really like help you find your value in yourself, and yeah. they're actively trying to shrink you. So if you yeah. are a mental health practitioner who is, you know, trying to support clients through encouraging diet and weight loss, I really want to ask you to consider to look a little bit deeper into the harm that that can cause.
Yeah, because to your point, it builds upon the pre-existing self-effacing thoughts, but it also negates and completely invalidates the actual mental health concerns. Right. Love that you love your therapist, though. Every therapist should have a therapist. Everyone should have a therapist. Yes. Therapy. For folks seeking to educate themselves, what are some resources, online, books, podcasts that they can check out and inform themselves and hopefully affirm themselves?
Yeah. So in terms of podcasts, I love Maintenance Faves. Mm-hmm. So that's with Aubie Gordon and Michael Hobbs. And it's kind of like a health and wellness podcast that debunks a lot of fatphobic societal influences, and they really do the research and are quite lovely and entertaining to listen to. So often I listen to episodes and I have like tears because I feel so seen and validated in how they show up and how they convey information in a way that like holds multiple truths. So they're really lovely. And then Aubie Gordon, so she's one of the co-hosts, but she's written two books.
Okay.
That I think that any larger bodied person and any ally to larger bodied folks needs to read or listen to.
Yeah.
So the first one's called What We Don't Talk About When We Talk About Fat. And then her other book, which came out more recently, is You Just Need to Lose Weight and Other Myths About Fat People. She is a delight in so many ways. She's so informed. And I think that her books offer both factual knowledge and first person experiences of what it's like to exist as a larger bodied person in this world. She often talks about and says, like, can anybody ask a fat person, right? Because there's so many yeah. narratives, there's so many panels, there's so many things that go on where people are talking about fat people, but their voices are not included. Right. So Aubie does a beautiful job of that. Awesome. There is a book called Fat and Queer, and it's like an anthology and has a lot of poetry and prose written by fat queer people.
That's awesome.
It kind of explores the intersectionality between that. So that is a lovely read that was written by Miguel Morales, Bruce Owens Grimm, and Tiff Joshua, and TJ Ferrantini. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing any of these names.
That's okay.
And then just it being a sex therapist, this has less to do with you know, body liberation work, but they are so interconnected.
Yeah.
Come As You Are, I can't recommend that book enough.
I was gonna ask. I think I see it on your shelf.
Oh yeah, there's. I have so many copies.
Is it there on that vertical stack of books behind you?
Yes, it is.
I saw that color as soon as you logged out. I was like, "It's Come As You Are."
I probably have like 10 copies because I throw it at my friends and my clients. I'm like, I don't even care if you give this back to me. Like, please read this. Like, please, please, please read this.
Oh, yeah.
If you are a woman, if you're someone who has sex with women, like, read this fucking book.
Yeah, seriously.
And then just to throw in a shameless self plug, my Instagram is, I try to post a lot of content on there. That either speaks to sexual health, fatness, queerness, and neurodivergence. Those are kind of my niche areas that I'm talking the most about. There I make infographics, I make silly videos, I disclose some things, and my hope is that by showing up in a space like that, somebody can see that and be like, oh, okay, I could, you know, too, be a therapist and be fat and be queer, or I could too find my own versions of success while holding these intersectional identities.
Yes, I love it. And yeah, this is a space for shameless plugs. So folks, I have linked Noelle's Instagram below, and I will list out those resources as well. So I'll add links so you can go buy the book, listen to the podcast, check out Noelle's work. All of that stuff should be below. And then I know you're, of course, based in Baltimore. Do you have a hybrid practice, or do you partner with folks in a telehealth capacity, or can you do?
So I do practice a kind of hybrid model.
Mm-hmm.
So I do in-person sessions for folks in Baltimore on Wednesdays and Thursdays, and then Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursdays, I also do telehealth.
Okay.
The way that licensure works as of right now, although they're working on a compact that's hopefully going to allow us to practice in different states. Right now, I only work with people who reside in the state of Maryland.
Okay.
So I do telehealth all over the state of Maryland. I also offer a consultation for therapists who are, I don't care where you are.
Yeah.
I can do consultation. I just can't do therapy.
Okay.
Outside of the state of Maryland. But I work with people who are seeking to, you know, have a more inclusive practice, how to sort of arrange their websites and media in a way that shows them as, you know, fat positive, sex positive, queer, competent, and informed.
Yes.
So I do consulting work in that way. And then I love to speak with people. So if you have a business, whether it's a therapy practice or something different, if you're looking to see how to have best practices in that way, I will come and talk to you. I will come and talk to your people.
Oh yeah.
I'm super, by the time that this comes out, I think both events will have already happened.
Okay.
But I'm speaking at the Philly FatCon the last weekend in October of 2023, and then the first weekend in January. I am doing a talk at FatCon, which is in Seattle, called Fat, Femme, and Fucked. And I am
so excited
about it. So yeah, if you want me to come and talk to you or talk to people, feel free to reach out to me. I love doing this kind of work.
That's awesome. That fills me with so much joy. And for folks based in Maryland, you know who to call.
Paula.
Therapists should always be growing, right? Everyone should always be growing. Yeah. Sounds like Noelle might just be your gal to become a better ally to your patients and clients. So give her a shout. And Noelle, you have a website as well, right? I can link that below.
Yeah, so it's just my full name, which is does not look as it is. It's not phonetically spelled in a way that makes sense. So it's noellebenick.com, but yeah. I'm sure putting that in the notes would help people out.
Yeah, perfect. So I will link that below. And so for any of the above, like, please reach out to Noelle. As you can tell, she knows her shit. So, and then I will follow up with you about any events that you have coming out closer to the episode release, and we can plug those publicly as well. But Noelle, thank you so much for taking the time this evening. It was really a pleasure to chat with you. This is a topic that folks often aren't comfortable talking about, or there's intersectionality, but we don't really get to the root of it on the show. And I'm excited to share this because I think it's really informative and insightful to folks, either larger bodied folks or folks who want to be allies and don't know how. So hopefully this is a great start for people. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. It's been a lot of fun, and I'm excited to see what this brings, and hopefully we can collaborate again in the future.
I would love that.
Yeah.
Folks, thanks for listening, and we will catch you next time. Bye.
Bye.